Episode 3896 of the Survival Podcast. It is Tuesday, September the 8th. This show I was originally going to do last Tuesday, and it had slipped my mind that last Tuesday was the first Tuesday, so that was a John and Nicole show. So I got a really early start today with this show, about 2 hours earlier than typical for a live stream during the week, because it was 90% done last week and ready to go. So anyway, we're going to have fun today. We're going to talk about one of my favorite subjects in the world, cooking. And whenever I do a show on cooking, you know, with a title like the Survival Podcast, I guess for certain people I have to reiterate, cooking is a survival topic because you have to eat every day. I've only ever been shot at once in my life. Like somebody actually shot at me. I didn't actually care for it. It's back when I was a young man in the military. It was a non-combat situation. Somebody still decided to turn it into one. But I've eaten most days of my life. I've gone some days fasting and whatever, but, you know, we have to eat. If we don't eat, we die. So it's a survival topic. I'm also going to reiterate something else, though, about this show and what it's always really been. The Survival Podcast is, before anything else, a lifestyle design podcast, and it's always been that. Preparedness is a piece of lifestyle design. If you have any design without redundancy built into it, any engineer will tell you what. You have a design that is not only going to fail, but will eventually fail catastrophically. And so that's the approach that we take, that things like generators, backup food, being smart about having some hard assets for hard times, and all of that are just ways to make sure that we stay on track in our lives no matter what goes on. And in 2026, man, this is more than a lifestyle design topic for some people. This is literally a modern survival topic. No, it's not because the zombies are coming. It's because the zombies came in the form of inflation, and it now costs an ever-loving fortune for a small amount of crap food at a restaurant, and that restaurant is just reheating Cisco shit. I mean, really, it's like a really good version of the TV dinner at a lot of places, and I'm talking like all your chains, like all your big chains, like your upper-tier chains. You know, for Mexican, like your Abuelos or your Glorias, or, you know, like a steak place, like if you're talking about like an Outback or something, they're pretty good still for those mid-tier chains. Anything below that, though, your Chili's, your Applebee's, all of that shit, it's all freaking reheated Cisco food, and that's all that it is. You know, all it changes is maybe the sauce they put on it or something like that. So you spend a huge amount of money, and even when you go to the grocery store, if you don't know how to make the most out of things, it's still incredibly expensive to eat well and to eat nutritiously in 2026. But it doesn't have to be. If you get creative, if you learn technique over recipe, and you learn how to take the things that cost less and make them better, higher quality. And if we learn to embrace a trend, we're going to talk today about how many foods that, you know, even 25, 30 years ago was foods of the poor. And certainly 40, 50 years ago. You go back to like when I was a kid in the 80s and the 70s in Florida, some of the food that was like I went to a Catholic school and we had a mix of people that were kind of middle class like we were and upper affluent. And we had some people in that school that were actually pretty damn poor, had to really stretch to be able to go to a private school, though it was pretty cheap back then. I think my tuition to go to private school when I was in grade school was $70 a month. I think that's what it was. And I think my sister and I both went and they gave us like a break. It was like 110 for both of us. Right. But, you know, these families were going out of their way to get their kids what they thought was a better education. And they had to stretch. And we'll talk about it today. But like shrimp and grits, they ate fish and grits or shrimp and grits all the time. Today, it's in most elevated restaurants. So a lot of things that we can take from the Depression era cooking and the foods of the poor and even slave foods a couple centuries ago have become considered extremely elevated cuisine. But you don't have to be a Michelin star chef to make that happen. So we're going to be talking about all of that and more today. Before we do, though, I want to remind you about our sponsors of the day today. Our sponsor today, number one today, is KnifeKits.com, where you can literally build an heirloom for your family. You know, go there, pick something out really cool, get a knife kit. if you need some help, get a book or a video or whatever to go with it, and build a knife with your son, your daughter, your nephew, your niece, your grandson, your granddaughter, etc. If I had a knife I had built with either of my grandfathers, I don't care if it didn't come out perfect. I would never part with it. You know, and then you build a couple more and you get a little bit better. Maybe you go and build a few and then do another one with the kids and create something a little more lasting. There's some pretty cool stuff there in kit form. Also, if you are a master bladesmith, if you're someone that's already got a lot of experience, this you're beyond the kit, they have all the raw materials too, and some really cool exotic stuff. Mammoth tusk, buffalo horn, buffalo bone, lots of cool stuff, plus kydex, leather, everything you can think of for making sheath making, holster making. Check them out today. And these guys are loyal. They became a sponsor in 2010. That's 16 years ago. So I don't know many podcasts the last 16 years, let alone podcast sponsorships that do. Next up today, thecaseplace.com. Protect your preps at up to 80% off retail. This is like Pelican, Hardig, SKB, and more. Inspected, field-ready, priced for the serious prepper. And these are, like, again, military-grade, law enforcement-grade cases. Some of the best that there is in the business. And because of the way they do business, they're able to offer them to you every day at 50 to 80% off. Now, on top of that, if you're a TSP listener, you get another 5% off your order. Use code TSP for that. If you're an MSB member, that's the member support brigade program that I have, you get 10% off your order. And so you can just log in your MSB to get those discounts. And that's a good time to remind you guys about the MSB and why you should become a member. You get discounts of things like this with the MSB. The MSB is really not a paid program. You got to pay to be in it, but if you use it, it pays you. I don't know anybody that has an MSB membership that uses it two or three times a year that doesn't say, I get my money back. It's 50 bucks a year. You know, if you use cannabis products, just things like the discounts from Akira Botanicals and some of our other supporters that do that business, man, you Angie's Garden, right? You one order and you're done. And there's a bunch of stuff above phone does discounts. Guys, if you're not a member, consider becoming a member. Help support my show. Make sure I'm here for you for many more years to come and get your money back plus some. All right. And just before we get all the way into it and start talking about this stuff, let's talk about the fall workshop real quick. 19th of September, tickets go on sale, 9:30 a.m. That's all I'll say today. Don't miss it. Pay attention. If you have never come to one before, please consider coming to one of these. If you're going to, I'd love to put it a different way. If you've always thought, one day I'm going to go to one of these events, one of Jack's workshops, make this the year. Make this the year. We do business like 60%+ of people that come have been here more than once. They come back because it's so special. But if you get up at 8 a.m. and be ready to go when we drop the link in the Telegram channel, that's Central Time, you'll probably get in. And we want to bring new people here, even if it's at the expense of some of the guys that get a little bit slow that want to be returning guests. All right, so let's start talking about this. Again, I want you to understand where we are in, like, the timeline when it comes to what I coined the phrase of as modern survivalism. And that is a phrase that I absolutely believe that I created. I when I started this show back in 08, I was like, I need a concept that I can hang my hat on that's really mine. That's not, you know, prepper or whatever, doomsday this or apocalyptic that. I wanted something that uniquely set us apart as, you know, a place where you could learn to live a better life if times got tough, or even if they didn't, like, to really meet our credo. And again, this was always about lifestyle design. And so modern survivalism incorporates all of it. It is about surviving the modern age and thriving in the modern age. And it doesn't limit itself to things breaking, and it doesn't throw out technology. Like, a lot of the prepper concepts are all about, like, when they turn the internet off, like, they're going to turn the internet off. If the internet goes off, something went wrong for everybody. They control you with the internet. They make all their money on the internet. They, whoever the hell you think they are not going to turn the internet off. But they will jack up the price of beef, you know, 2x over the last 4 years. They'll do that. They will take all kinds of policies and practices that make your money worth less. And as I said in the lead up to this, you need to eat. We want to eat, and we want to eat good. And the approach that most people take to high food prices is to buy the shittiest, pre-made, low-end, crappy, carbohydrate-intensive, additive food that there is that's cheap, but your mind thinks it tastes good because it doesn't taste good. We slowly ramp into these things like Hot Pockets and pizza turnovers and shit, which, you know, if you're Gen X, you probably ate a lot of those as a kid because you came home and you threw them in the oven. And I guess maybe that's part of our training that led us down this road. We were kids. We didn't know how to do some of the stuff I'm going to talk about today. So we just made do with what we had. But that became the go-to for everybody. Everybody's tired. Everybody's working their ass off. People are cash-strapped. Generally, when they get home, they just want to go. So if you can grab something with a brand name on it out of the freezer and throw it in the microwave or the oven and feed everybody, you feel pretty good about it. But the quality of the food is crap. And that means your health will go to crap. I've often said, if you think good food's expensive, wait till you see what insulin costs. Wait till you see what dialysis costs. Wait till you see what cardiothoracic surgery costs. You know, like, what do you see what being on 12 maintenance medications in your 50s or 40s now costs? Yeah, then maybe you'll understand that this isn't really expensive, especially if we think about it more like our grandparents. So some of the things I want to just kind of hit on today are some of the real values and the values you can gain by, you know, using them. And so to me, the two biggest values, and I am not going to try to stick to like grass-fed only, organic only today, like buy the quality that you can afford in the class that you can. But all of these things are going to be less expensive than a lot of their counterparts of the same level. So if it's, you know, like CAFO production stuff that you buy in the grocery store, okay, fine. These things are going to cost less than something like that same class of thing for a New York strip. But if you go to organic, grass-fed, whatever, depending on where we're talking, or, you know, pasture-raised, these pieces will still cost less than the other pieces parts, right? So to me, one of the best values, and I'm going to amend my own notes here and add drumsticks to this as well, but chicken thigh. Chicken thigh to me is one of the best values in protein on the planet if you have to go to the store and buy food. There's nothing you can do with a chicken breast that I can't do with a chicken thigh. And unless you are wanting, like, I know people like, ew, they eat dark meat. Shut up. If somebody blindfolded you and two people made you want a chicken breast and the other made you a thigh the same way, you're going to pick the thigh every time. It has more flavor. It's juicier. It can handle higher heat without drying out. And the big thing is, because we're busy, thigh has the ability to be cooked on a weekend and reheated on a Wednesday and not dry out on that second reheat. That's one of the bigger pieces of the magic to it to me. So here's what I mean. I can make you something with chicken breast. It will be juicy. It will taste amazing. You'll be like, this is great. But when you cook that, basically heating up is the second cooking. It will just not be right on that heat up. Or if I do the same thing with thigh, it will be. The one thing that you can learn that I think will make all of this work better is basic meat cutting principles and how to bone a thigh. If you do not know how to bone a chicken thigh, you need to learn. You basically flip it on its back, follow the bone, peel the bone off with the tip of the knife, cut it off, and cut the little piece of cartilage off the end. If that doesn't make sense to you, go look up a video, how to bone a chicken thigh. If you want it skinless, then you just pull the skin off of it. Don't throw the skin away. Don't do that. That's dumb. Like if you are doing something with chicken thigh where you need it skinless, peel all the skins off and then put them like on a cookie sheet, roast them in the oven on like a cooling rack, nest it into a sheet pan. All that fat that drips down there, that is some of the best cooking fat in the world. It is amazing. If you want it to be a flavored fat, when you roast that chicken, take 4 or 5 cloves of garlic, bash them with a knife, leave the paper on them, put them in the pan under the chicken thigh skins, and when the fat melts down on them, it'll roast that garlic. You can take that garlic and do something else with it, but it'll infuse garlic flavor into the chicken schmaltz. So now you have a fat to cook with. So now we've gone from buying like $6 a pound breast to buying like dollar something a pound thigh, and we've already got multiple products out of it. We deboned it. We can make a bone broth. We made a crispy chicken skin, which is just delicious and straight up eating, cut into strips and put on top of other things like a chicken chicharron. Plus, we have a schmaltz for cooking it. We haven't even got started yet, and we've got more product. But thigh, if you want to do something that's more like where you would pound a breast out, once you debone it, you can kind of put it to some plastic wrap or put it in a plastic bag and pound it out to a cutlet. And you can do anything with it. You want to do like a nugget type thing or a stir fry. It all works. I also love to just cook thighs with the skin on, bone out. They cook faster that way because you spread them open. And cook them skin side down first, bring up a nice crisp on the skin, flip them over, flat top, frying pan, oven, any of it, or bone in. All of those things are valid. What I love to do with legs, the chicken legs, and this is why sometimes quarters are a good deal too. You just break them in half yourself if you don't want to cook them whole. Take your chicken legs, go to the side where the meat is closest to the bone, and go like you're going to bone it, but don't take it all the way off the bone. Okay, butterfly it out so it lays flat. It'll cook evenly. And whatever you season it with will get into the meat. And so you've got a crispy side for skin. So you can sear the skin and then flip it over after the seasoning has cooked in or the marinade or the sauce is cooked into the leg. And that way, when you turn it over, the skin finishes crisp because it can air dry as it cooks. You want to do something really cool with those? Make those that way and use Walker's Wood Jamaican Jerk Seasoning as your – that's all, literally the only thing you need. Rub it on the skin lightly and rub it deeply and heavily on the inside, on the backside. Again, cook skin side down, flip over to finish. They will finish in about half the time as if you don't butterfly them open. So chicken dark meat pieces, one of the best prices on the market. And I'll also add this. If you like chicken breasts and you want chicken breasts, buy whole chickens and learn to break them down. I've done the math, and usually it works out this way. The price of two boneless, skinless chicken breasts is about the same as the whole chicken. You get the boneless breasts, you get the rest of the chicken for free. It's about the same price. So that's one of my big value cuts. Another is pork shoulder. And the place I know to get the best deal on pork shoulder is Costco. Yes, it's commercial pork, but it's super good, high quality, very inexpensive. I think I just smoked 8 pork shoulders for the workshop, and I just broke down another 4 pork shoulders to make Jamaican jerk sausage for the workshop. I paid $2.29 a pound for boneless pork shoulder, big old twin packs at Costco. Let me tell you some things that you can do them. Question. Okay, I'm going to answer this question mid-flow. Question. Workshop tickets sale yesterday was 9 a.m. Today, 9:30. 9 a.m. If I said 9:30, it's a mistake. I'm sorry. 9 a.m. Central Standard Time. So I'll dick that question off. All right. So anyway, when you get those pork shoulders, you open it up. And if you're going to smoke the whole shoulder, open that flap up, put your rub inside, then close it back up and do the rub outside. Get some butcher's twine and tie that roast up. If you're going to smoke it, roast it, whatever. And the reason is because it's kind of flappy, you end up with thin and thick parts, and it cooks at different rates. So you can overcook some and undercook some others, and it makes it harder to keep an even low and slow for that smoke. So that's your basic thing there. But the stuff that you can do with it, I had friends come over last night. And when I was breaking down the shoulders for the sausage, the top of the shoulder, the pork shoulders that you buy from Costco, is the muscle that comes up to the neck. That's the copa, like copa ham, like really high-end, expensive Italian-cured ham, copa. So what you do is if you set that shoulder kind of like this so you know which way the head goes, that whole top back strip there, the forward half of it anyway is going to be the about half of the copa. The rest, it's going to end up with the rest of the pig somewhere else. You cut those into like 3/4 to 1 inch chops, and you'll get 4 to 5 out of one of those, depending on how big it is. There is no better pork chop on planet Earth. They actually look more like little pork steaks. Incredible marbling. Season it how you like it. Good hard sear. Cook it to about 150 degrees, right? It's pork. It does not need to be 165 or whatever. Cook it to 145. It'll be fine. And I served that to my guests last night, and all I did was a basic rub, like garlic, salt, pepper, et cetera, a little bit of paprika, a little bit of smoked pepper. And everybody said it was fantastic. And all it was just fried, like in a pan, because it was too hot to go back outside. I was like, I'm not going back outside until October. It's too hot out there. And so I did it just frying pan, a little bit of olive oil, and like a teaspoon of butter. The oil and the butter together keep the butter from over-scorching. Incredible. The value of that piece of meat at $2.20-something a pound, you can do anything with it. If you do like a beef pork mixture in chili, it's great for that. If you like sausage, it's great for that. One of the best things you can do, though, if you're going to break it down into cuts, so you have that copa, then you have the big, thick piece that's nice and stable. It's not flappy and sloppy like that other side is. You just cut steaks out of that however you want. Call them pork steaks, call them chops, call them country style ribs. I don't care. And you can do them thin or thick. You can do any kind of marinade or seasoning. All of it is just, it's tender. It's got enough fat in it to stay juicy. It's so much better than a loin that costs twice as much. It really is. Then that flappy side, the best thing to do with that, in my opinion, if you're not going to do like a whole roast or something, go ahead and take that flappy side off and cut it up and either do stir fry with it or do grind with it. If you do grind with it, one of the really great things you can do is learn how to make a basic breakfast sausage. So I'm going to put this up on my screen, but you can find everything in the show notes today. This is my basic sausage recipe. And this is like a sage-flavored breakfast sausage. And I'll go ahead and give you the ingredients real quick. But again, you can come to the site and get this. And then you just scale it up or down. 1 pound of ground pork, 1 teaspoon of fennel, 1/2 teaspoon of crushed red pepper flakes. And if you don't like spicy, eliminate it or mitigate it. You know, use less. About 1/2 teaspoon of salt. I usually use like a Himalayan pink or a Redmond's with this. 1/2 teaspoon of black pepper. In this recipe, I called for 1/2 teaspoon per pound of Chef Keith's Northern Italian seasoning. He doesn't make it anymore. That's how old this recipe on the side is. But any good like Italian seasoning, 1 teaspoon of garlic powder, 1 teaspoon of onion powder, and 4 finely chopped fresh sage leaves. All you do is just mix that together until it gets sticky. That's how you know a sausage is done, when the fat and the protein begin to emulsify together. You can make that so quickly. You need absolutely no, and I mean no specialized equipment for that all other than a grinder. And you can use something like a food processor for small amounts of mince, as the British would call it. So basically, you dice up your meat, you put it in a food processor, and you pulse it until you get the consistency you want. You know what? Season it first before you do that. It'll be mixed in ground in one go. But it is hard to beat, for an investment, the little grinder that I have on my site, the little grinder that could until it couldn't anymore. The STX 3000 Turbo Force grinder, it's about $160, brand new on Amazon. When you open yourself up to getting these larger cuts, chuck rolls, pork shoulder, et cetera, and taking all that extra trim and being able to do your own grind, that grinder will pay for itself, you know, in a couple months, like 3 or 4 months of use, it will pay for itself. And I just finally upgraded to a Cabela's Carnivore. I got a number 22 grinder. It will grind a chicken leg quarter with the bones in it like it's nothing. It is amazing. And it was almost $650 shipped. And I kicked myself for not buying one sooner. I bought the 1 horsepower one. And I wanted to go up to like the number 32 one but that was like $800. I just couldn't bring myself to do it. In spite of the fact that I'm glad I finally bought it, that little Turbo Force I've had for over 10 years, I have put hundreds of pounds through it, And if you're using it like we're talking about today, not what I did yesterday. Yesterday, I ground 32 pounds of sausage with the seasoning added already. Okay. That would have put a beating on this little guy in one go. But when you're grinding, you know, 5 pounds or less per run, these things are fantastic. Moving on from there, and also a good case for a grinder, is your chuck rolls, your chuck claws. Those are two of the best beef primal ROIs. So your chuck roll is like kind of like the neck upper shoulder, and your chuck claw is like the lower shoulder off of a cow. These cuts off of like a lamb or a deer or a smaller pig would be like in one big cut. We're talking about beef cattle. That's a big hunk of meat. A chuck roll is going to be 20 pounds or more sometimes, and a clawed the same. But the chuck roll is probably the best value. You can literally take one of those and just from the back going forward, start cutting giant freaking Flintstone steaks out of it and cut them in half if you want to. Your first couple will basically be a chuck eye on one side and a Denver steak on the other, but you can cook them all together if you want to. And you can go up till you're about halfway through it before it will start to kind of not really be a good steak anymore. Now, I'm not saying that the first half of it, these steaks will be equivalent to like a filet mignon or a ribeye, but they're really damn good, especially if you treat them right. The rest of it, you can do all types of things. Stir fry, grind, you name it. You can do roasts, right? Your typical pot roast, which is your typical thing that they sell in the store. They call it pot roast. It's just a piece of chuck roll. And they generally just bust those things into big, giant, like 2-inch thick slabs and say pot roast. So you can also, when you go to the store and they have pot roast on sale, just look at it. And the ones that are nice, that you see something that looks kind of like a little ribeye, and then you see this thing almost looks like short ribs around it, one side's chuck eye, one side's Denver. You can literally buy that, pull it apart, and portion it as you want. Like usually when they're 2 inches thick, you can take that chuck eye side, bust it into 2 1-inch steaks, poor man's ribeye. And then your Denver, you decide how you want to break that up. But those are incredible values. The chuck clawed will have the Terrace Major, which is one of the most incredibly delicious cuts of meat. It kind of looks like a smaller filet mignon, like a whole filet mignon. It's not quite as tender, but it's damn good, except a lot of times now when you buy a clawed, they're taking the Terrace Major off and they're marketing it as a separate cut. So you're getting ripped off for that. But the thing that's always in the clawed, the flat iron steak. The flat iron steak is one of those things that they found when the beef union was trying to find more ways to make more value in a cow. Flat irons are everywhere now in steakhouses and places like Boomer Jacks and stuff. They're doing like a small portion, 5 to 6 ounce portion of steak with something like steak and shrimp or what have you. It's amazing. It takes a little time to learn how to do it. It's basically a long rectangular strip, and there's a piece of like fat and cartilage and membrane going down the middle, and you take it off both sides. And again, you'll get about 3 per side. So you'll get, depending on the size of the clawed, 4 to 6 of these per clawed. Most of the rest of the clawed is better to cut into things like slow braising cuts, like mock short ribs and stuff like that, or turn into grind. But it's an incredible value. And I'll throw one more at you. If you go to like Costco Business Center, any place they have these, a whole top butt sirloin. Those tend to be incredible values as well. You take the top off. That's your picanha. That's your cap. You decide how you want to process that. And then the rest you can make basic sirloins, top sirloin, your baseball steaks and stuff like that. All of these things can be had for between $6 and $8 a pound. Or you can go to the grocery store where somebody's cut them for you and pay $8 to $22 a pound. It's as simple as learning how to use a knife, okay? And we got that question answered. I mentioned the meat grinders, and I'll tell you another really great investment is a meat slicer. If you want to pick up a meat slicer, I have one I recommend by Vavor. And it is a 10-inch commercial meat slicer. I'm going to say something. If I had this to do again, I would have spent the extra like $80 and bought the 12-inch one. Not so much because it performs better, but because when you have a bigger meat slicer, you have a longer throw for bacon. So I would to have another 2 inches of throw on the arm, I would definitely be willing to spend a little bit more money on them. I looked them up today, and on Vivor's site, both the 10 and 12 inches are sold out. They have none in stock. However, I would really recommend a product like this. If you're going to buy one anyway from the Vivor brand, I would buy it on Amazon. So I have links in the show notes. They do have some in stock of both sizes on Amazon. And the reason I say that is before, sometimes you might get a lemon and they're not great on customer service, but Amazon's great on customer service. So you might want to take that approach anyway. But the reason the meat slicers are so valuable, let's give another really great example. You go out and buy a whole eye of rounds, one of the cheapest cuts of meat there is. And everybody says, it's just junk or whatever, it's too lean. And then they cut the fat off it. Like, what are you doing? You cut your ends off, your little pointed ends. You do a Chinese type marinade with that, where you tenderize it. Because most of what you're eating in like Chinese restaurants, like beef and broccoli, is either eye round or like top round or bottom round. And they do the velveting thing and all that I won't get into today for that. But you do whatever you want. You can throw it in your grind, your trim, whatever. But now you have a nice round squared off roast. It's pretty damn big. If you really want to get it to roast evenly, learn to do a butcher's knot and put about 4 or 5 string wraps on it and tie it up, and then season it however you want, throw it in the oven, make a roast beef. Cook it to 130 degrees maximum, right? I like to cook it to about 125 with a remote thermometer plugged in so I know what the temperature is. And at 125, I shut the oven off and I leave it closed for like 4 hours. And that will do carry over up to about the 130 range. You can even do like 120. It'll still carry over to about 133, nice and rare. And unlike cutting into a hot piece of meat, it's not going to bleed. It's going to look like beautiful roast beef from the deli. Okay? Throw that on a slicer, and you just made roast beef better than they're selling you for $18 a pound at the deli for about $6 a pound. It's that simple. If you want that fat cap that's on there, after you've made your roast beef and before you put it on the slicer, go ahead and take it off with a knife. Throw it back in the oven under the broiler till it crisps. Because your roast beef won't need it on a sandwich. It'll just be a little thin strip. You take that, I'm talking about an untrimmed one, that fat will curdle up and be one of those beautiful things you've ever eaten in your life if you try it that way. But again, you get any flavor that you want on your roast beef. And your temperature, to do what I just said, you're going to want to run that oven at about 400 degrees. Preheat 400, throw it in, bring it up to 120, 125, depending on what your final doneness is you want. Shut it off, and unless the world ends, do not open the door for 4 hours. That's all you got to do. You end up with a beautiful, promise you, beautiful piece of meat on the cheap. Let's also talk about like soups. You know, my grandmother's both. Anything that was left over that wasn't going to get eaten was turned into a soup. Anything that was processed and had some trim and bones was turned into a soup. When we did like carrots and all, they didn't buy the little bags of like the baby carrots that are on a little lathe or something to make them all the same. You know, they bought carrots. And the tops and the ends, that went into a broth. The bottom of the celery, into a broth. Like the bottom piece of an onion, into a broth. Everything went into a broth, and like any leftover meat or any cheap piece of meat could be turned into a soup. An old chicken turned into a soup. And I'll tell you that my two grandmothers were very different people. One was a first generation Ukrainian immigrant. The other was a first generation Italian immigrant. They made very different foods. My grandmother from Ukraine was big on pierogies and halukis and galumpkis and all Eastern European foods, lots of potatoes, baking bread, stuff like that. My Italian grandmother, lasagna, right? Chicken parmesan, eggplant parmesan, right? Hardly ever baked anything except cookies at Christmas. Very, very different people. My Italian grandmother and my grandfather on that side was a retired military officer, a little bit more affluent, actually a lot more affluent than my other grandparents who grew up poverty region, coal region. Very, very different people, but they both made soups all the time. You know what their commonality was? They both lived through the Great Depression and World War II. And so you don't throw away food. I told my wife the other day, I found this jar and had some seasoning and shit in it. It's just like a small ball jar. And it would have taken, you know, half an hour of getting everything out of it and making it clean again. And I threw it away. So my Ukrainian grandmother would have freaking flipped her shit that I threw that jar away. She didn't throw jelly jars away, right? They didn't waste things. A milk carton was rinsed out so things could be frozen in it because it was a free container to put in the freezer, right? People that lived through that time, that's how they thought. If foil could be reused, you didn't throw it away, you reused it, that type of thing. This is, okay, there's one of those people. We'll get rid of you later. Anyway, moving on. So everybody who lived through the Depression made soups. And so I encourage you to learn to make a good soup. And the first step is learning to make a good base. This is taking all of your vegetables and doing like a mirepoix, sofrito, or whatever. Then you add your bones and everything to make your stock. You're going to get a much richer soup that way. And I'm telling you, it can be super easy. You don't have to become a French cook to do this. When I had Josiah as an intern here way back, if you remember like those years, his mom was down here for about 3 weeks from Montana. And anything we had left over, she just threw it all in a crock pot, threw some herbs and seasoning in it, ground up some rosemary and thyme and threw that in there. And whatever it was always good. So don't let stuff go to waste. I know so many people, you know, they have leftovers and they don't put them to use. And then you don't want to reheat them up. And by the end of the week, you look at it and go, that's not very nice. Make soup out of it. And this is where I want to start talking about some of the Depression era foods, the foods of the poors, things like that, that we now go to very expensive restaurants and pay a lot of money for, but because they're foods of the poors, they're actually really easy to make. Now, some of these restaurants have definitely elevated them, especially with some of their seasonings, sauces, and techniques. But the basics are still really easy. The first one that I think of is shrimp and grits whenever I think about this. And I have been to some really great restaurants. And almost all of them today have a shrimp and grits thing on the menu, especially if they're kind of like low country Carolina, southern cooking, things like that. One place I've been to in Fort Worth, if you ever get a chance to go, is a little place called Little Red Wasp. They do a shrimp and grits that's fantastic. The lunch menu at a restaurant in downtown Fort Worth called Riata, which is a super high-end place, they do a shrimp and grits. It's freaking fantastic. But what do I remember about shrimp and grits? I remember, again, being in Catholic school and having this family that we were close friends with. They really struggled. I mean, they had three boys, and they had to make sacrifices to send those kids to Catholic school. Serious sacrifices. At the low price that I gave you. Now, again, you're talking to early 80s, but still, like, I'm just saying, they were on the edge financially. And almost every Catholic, you don't eat meat on Fridays, right? So almost every Friday, if you ask them what you're having, the answer was either fish and grits or shrimp and grits. Why? Grits are cheap, right? You buy a big giant box of them, they're cheap. Big giant bag of them, they're cheap. And in Florida at the time, every time you were driving down the road and you went past like an inlet where you had like an overpass that people fished on, that was like that went out to the St. John's River or went out to the ocean, there's somebody there with a cast net catching shrimp. And there'd be a guy with a cooler selling them right off the side of the road. And you could buy shrimp. I don't remember exactly what it was under $1 a pound live shrimp and big old live shrimp. So it was super cheap. Now you add some, you know, a really good sauce. You add something like a Cajun blackening season, like Paul Perdomo's Cajun blackening season. You cook your shrimp separately, and you bring them to the grits, and you do a good sauce. Oh, my God. And you use lots of cheese in your grits, of course. All I'm making the point of here is you're taking a food that this family ate all the time to where they were like, fish and grits again. Because if it wasn't shrimp and grits, you went somewhere and caught some catfish or some, you know, speck trout or something like that, and you did it with fish. Again, very high end today. How about short ribs and osso busco, right? Short rib is gotten very expensive, right? And that's, you know, your bottom part of the rib primal. And the other problem with short rib today is that they take so much of the meat off the ribs that there's not really much there, and or they go ahead and bone it for you, and then it's like $14, $16 a pound meat, okay? Here's the thing. You go back to that chuck roll that I talked about, and when you're learning to part that out, look for the stuff with lots of fat grain in it, cut that in the shape of the short rib, and do your favorite short rib recipe with it. Now you have short ribs with way more meat on them for $6 a pound. See how quick that works? Now, here's the secret. When you go to that nice upper end Italian restaurant that has a red wine braised short ribs with like baby portobello mushroom or something with it, right? Do you know what you're eating? You're eating what I just told you. None of these places are doing that. Another thing that makes really great short rib stand-ins, if you buy a whole Packer's brisket, if you can do it, because I like to cook it separately as its own thing, the point of the brisket, the part they make the chopped brisket out of, if you cut that into that kind of shape and strip, it's fantastic. But this was always that bottom rib plate. It was a poor people food. Now it's considered one of the most like desirable pieces of beef there is. Osso Busco literally means small hole, and it is the shank of a beef. It can be front or rear, and it's basically everything. Like if you were a cow and you were on all fours, everything from your elbow down to your wrist, that piece would be the shank, right? And it's a very tough cut, but it's very, very flavorful. It has a lot of marbled fat in it. It does have some membranes and fascia and stuff like that, but it is perfect for long, slow cooking a braise. Again, a red wine reduction, something like that. This is still relatively affordable, especially if you pay attention. This is a cut. Watch for them to put it on sale. And when they put it on sale, that's when to pick it up. Coquevin. Coquevin is a classic French housewife's use for an old rooster. It literally means cock and wine is what it means. Not that kind of cock, the rooster cock, right? And it's basically a slow-cooked chicken dish. It can be served over noodles or potatoes. It's made with red wine. It's a slow cook. That way the chicken becomes tender, even though it's designed for an older bird. Top restaurants are selling this. I'm talking Michelin-star restaurants now have Coquevin on the menu. There's a restaurant. If you don't follow these guys, you want to learn a lot about cooking. They run a restaurant in London. It's like the hottest restaurant in London right now. It's called Fallow, F-A-L-L-O-W. They do a Coquevin that is just so super elevated, but it's not, even the super elevated version is not hard. And so a lot of you guys have birds, and every so often you need to bring in new birds. And if you keep chickens to lay eggs, you know that they're not a great meat product. Like chicken really is either you got a meat chicken or you got an egg chicken. And there's some dual purpose that are okay, but neither excels. But when you have a year and a half or 2.5-year-old hen, it doesn't matter if it's a dual breed. It just doesn't really make a good fried chicken or something. It'll make a fantastic Coquevin. In fact, the older and tougher the bird is, the more suited to Coquevin it is. And I'll give you a hack for cleaning so you don't have to be out there plucking all of a chicken. Dispatch your bird, however you do that. I use either a killing cone or just hang them from a tree with some TA-50 cord and neck slice in a bucket to bleed them out. Once they're bled out, pluck the breast. The breast will pluck super easy. Take your knife, take your breast cutlets off the breast with the skin on. Now you've got skin on, right? Then pop the joints out of your leg quarters and pull the skin back, cut the foot off, and take your leg quarters from that bird. And the rest of it, if you want to go through all the grief to get what's left of it out of a cold bird, go ahead. I don't. That's it. I take the liver, I take the heart, and things like that. It goes to the black soldier flies at that point. Let them take care of it. Turn it into something useful. But that'll make a great Coquevin, a fantastic. And when you do it right with the red wine, the meat is almost stained with the red wine. And it is a fantastic meal, okay? Oxtail. Oxtail was literally slave food. Like the master slaughtered the cow and they gave the slave the tail. It's a super popular thing down in the Caribbean because it was slave food. So like Haiti, Dominican Republic, Cuba, Puerto Rico. But now it's on the menus of top restaurants. If you try it, you'll see why. My granddad used to make an oxtail soup that was amazing. It's more like a stew. It's so gelatinous that the broth thickens just from what renders out of the cut. It's a fantastic, fantastic cut. And I don't necessarily want you to go start making shipping grits and cookavin, osso busco, and oxtail. I want you to just start thinking about the fact that these things that used to literally be considered not good enough for the table of a proper gentleman are now sitting in Michelin star restaurants. Another example is pork belly. Nobody even has a stigma against pork belly because we all eat bacon, right? But pork belly, again, this was like, you know, you slaughtered the hog and you just cut the belly flap away, here, slave. That's how it's like Chinese roasted pork belly skin on with a crisp chicharron skin. Oh, my God. T. Glacier says, lobster was that way, too. Yeah, that ship's gone. But, yeah, lobster was prison food in New England. The lobster population was so high in New England when we first began to settle here from Europe that you could walk the beach and find lobsters. It's almost hard for me to believe that, right? Like, it doesn't make any sense to me. Like, why would they be? They're a deep water animal, but apparently they were. I've never even dug into that. I'm not even sure if maybe they were a little bit different species of lobster that we don't have anymore or what. But yeah, lobster was prison food. There's so many things that were good. Like shrimp was basically looked at the same way. It was like what you ate to survive. You know, it wasn't what, you know, because it's all you could get at the time. It's basically an ocean roach or something. Let's talk about some techniques too, though, because I think techniques are way more important than recipes. So using fresh herbs and knowing how to use fresh herbs. So what you don't want to do with fresh herbs, if you're making an herb-crusted roast, that is not the place for your fresh herbs. So we're going to crust, let's say, a rib, like a prime rib, and then we're going to slow roast it, and then we're going to serve it like a proper prime rib at a restaurant. There's your place for, like, your dry rosemary, your dry thyme. Maybe you put a little bit on top of it to kind of baste in the meat. But that herb is going to be completely cooked out by the time it comes out of there. Fresh herbs are for finishing. Fresh herbs are for, let's say you're making a pizza, right? You make a pizza. I don't care if you go to the grocery store and buy a freezer pizza, okay? Do a little pizza surgery, frozen pizza surgery. Anybody know what I mean when I say frozen pizza surgery? That's where you kind of like rearrange all the toppings and maybe you add some more pepperoni or something. And you cook that pizza in just a plain old oven. You want to take it to another level? Get some fresh basil. Stack your leaves together like you're making a cigar. Roll it up tightly and then cut it so they're long, thin strips, really, really thin. That's called a chiffonade. And then when that pizza comes out, sprinkle the fresh basil on top of it after it's done cooking. It'll take a freezer pizza to another level. So if you make your own or you just do torn leaves, the same type of thing. When you do a soup, throw your herbs on at the end. You know, chives, just any cut of meat, finely chopped onion chives. Fantastic. So simplistic. And what I love about the herbs, it opens up growing some of your own food to everybody. You can have an herb garden that's, you know, 6 to 12 pots that are, you know, big enough to just pick up and move around. Oregano, chives, thyme, rosemary. Basil, right? Those five alone will do a ton for you with fresh herbs. Parsley is another great fresh herb. You know, those six. In fact, I should probably do a whole show on just herb gardening again pretty soon. So fresh herbs. Salt crusting thick cuts of meat before searing. So this is a new one on me. I've always done the salt to meat thing. I've always done the dry brine in the refrigerator thing. We'll talk about in a minute. But I recently was watching the Fallow Guys. And, you know, you're talking, if you're going to do this, you're talking like 1-inch minimum thick cuts. And what they were doing it with was a fillet that was probably 1.5 inches thick, maybe a little thicker even. But to get the best sear, you put down a fine salt, like on a cutting board or a plate, and you take the flat part of the meat that's going to go on and get seared, and you just, like you're breading a fish fillet, stick it on top of the salt, flip it over, stick it on top of the salt. It seems like a lot, but when you're talking about a thick cut of meat, it can only penetrate so far into that meat. The sear you get when you do that is absolutely freaking amazing. Absolutely freaking amazing. So start crusting your thick cuts. Proper cutting. Like, you do all this work, and then I'm not even talking about when you're preparing the cut to cook. You bring the cut of meat off the grill, out of the frying pan, whatever. You let it rest. You're ready to cut it. You want to be cutting across the way the grain flows on that cut, because your meat will then pull apart the grain, where if you cut it long ways, here's a classic example of where people screw this up all the time. With skirt steak for fajitas. It's natural that you kind of want your fajita steak to be like long, thin strips. That's very classic. And if you want to do that, if you use flank steak to make fajitas, when you bring your flank steak off, let's say it's 12 inches, and you want your strips to be about 6 inches long, cut it in half with the grain, turn it, and cut your strips across the grain. It will heat so much better because you cut it differently. There's cuts of meat where it's not that big of a deal, like a ribeye. The whole thing's tender. The whole thing's marbled. The grain kind of does all kinds of things going on there. But there are many cuts of meat that one simple change will do so much for you. Simple sauces. And a lot of simple sauces can just be broth reductions with some herbs and butter. So one of the things that I'm going to be making for you guys, we're going to have a small bites porch, probably about 2 hours on Friday at the workshop. Chef Ken's going to help me with it. I talked to him on the phone yesterday. I'll tell you some more cool stuff about that near the end. But we're going to be making like four different things for you that are pre-made. And one is called potato fondant. Potato fondant. And fondant basically means melt. So it's a potato that melts when you eat it. And it's a very easy thing to do. I'm not going to get into how to do it right now. But it takes a long time. And so it's something served at very elevated restaurants. And what it involves doing is browning these pucks. Like, you basically make a potato puck that's really thick. You brown both sides. You bring a broth up to just cover it, like you're doing a braise. You cover it with what's called a cartouche, which is basically a piece of parchment paper to slow evaporation, and you slow cook it in the oven for about an hour. Then you bring it out, you reduce down the broth, you glaze the potatoes, and you serve it. It's amazing. And it's not hard. It's just time consuming. I came up the way I can make, 80 in a day and take them out of the freezer and make them whenever I want to. I made it scalable. And I finally dialed the recipe in. We had friends over last night that I did the pork chops for, and I did a potato fondant, and the sauce that was on the potatoes was right in with them when they were made. I won't say how, but you might imagine CV has something to do with this. And all I did was reduce that beef broth with all the herbs and garlic in it down until it was thick like a glaze. But you can do that. You don't have to make a fondant to do that. You can do that with anything. If you take sage and butter, and you take the butter till it browns, and then you incorporate in and emulsify a broth, like a beef broth or a chicken broth, and you reduce that down to a thick glaze, it's good on anything. To quote Guy Fieri, it'd be good on a napkin. I mean, it's that simple. And it's a combination of meat flavors, herbs, salt, and some spice. That's always what it comes down to. And I don't believe that any sauce is harmed by the addition of garlic. I'll put it that way. A little thing on your garlic, right? I got more on your garlic here in a second. But when you're doing sauces and stuff like that and you want to flavor the sauce with the garlic, bash the garlic, leave the paper on it, throw it in the pan. It won't over roast the garlic and get that burnt. And then you can, if you want to use the garlic, you can pull it out with a pair of tongs, and that garlic will pop right out of there and be nice and soft, which brings me to my next one, roasting garlic into a paste. This is one of the best food hacks in the world, and I don't know why more people don't do it. It is so simple to do. You take your whole head of garlic, you lay it on its side, so you got your roots like to your holding hand, and you take your knife and you cut the top right off it. You want to take just enough of the top of the garlic, the whole bulb, off, that when you look at it, you can see into the individual cells of all the little garlics. You put that in a piece of aluminum foil. You pour some olive oil on it, or you can use beef tallow. You can use any kind of a good quality fat. Big pinch of salt and pepper. Close the foil around it. Throw it in the oven at 350 until it's soft. Let it cool down because it will be screaming hot when it comes out. Whatever you want to use it on, you open the foil, you grab the bottom of the bulb, and you squeeze, and it comes out like a what it is, roasted garlic paste. Nice and salted and peppered and already seasoned, and it's good on everything. Tell you what it's good on. You take a piece of just simple sourdough toast, and you squeeze that onto it, and you smear that, and you just eat it the way that it is. But if you add any, like, take mackerel, the canned mackerel that I recommend from Wild Planet, you take that and you add some garlic to it and you just saute it briefly in a pan with like some jalapeno peppers and you smear that garlic on the sourdough and then you put the mackerel, crumbled mackerel on top of it and then get some really good Parmesan cheese and like a microplane grater and let that parm just melt into it. Let it cool for just a second. One of the most amazing things, you have a couple bucks into that. And it'll take a person that says, I don't like fish. If you don't tell them what it is and they eat it, it's on. You could add a little bruschetta to that, which is basically chopped tomatoes. And I'm not going to get into how to do that one today, but you can look up how bruschetta, bruschetta are both proper ways to say it. Add that to that. Or just do the garlic schmear and the bruschetta. Holy crap. This stuff is easy. It's super easy. You notice something? I'm not trying to be keto today because not all of you are, and that's okay. And we have a few cheat days a week, right, if you want to call it that. But what I'm also not doing, you're not hearing any garbage food. You're not hearing any junk food. You're not hearing – like a potato is one thing. You know, a mixed up batch of crap with potato slop in it is another. You're not hearing anything that's come out of a box here. This is all the way you think about this. This is the way we ate. And I've always said this about the carnivore keto thing even. Somehow our grandparents and our parents ate all the things that we don't think we should eat anymore, and they didn't get fat. They ate bread. They ate potatoes. Like my Ukrainian grandmother, if it was a potato, it went in something. A bellini, a pierogi, whatever. They didn't get fat. But you know what they didn't eat? They didn't eat shit that came in a box that you look at, there's 57 ingredients and you can't pronounce 50 of the 57. They didn't eat seed oils. They didn't eat high fructose corn syrup. They didn't eat food dyes. That's where we have to be at, you know, in our world, I think, today to at least get headed in the right direction. Also, marinades. Learn to do good marinades. And another item that I think is a fantastic ROI very, very quickly is a good chamber vacuum sealer. Now, I know a lot of people use like the Food Saver vacuum sealers and all, and they're very cheap, but they're really not. A good Food Saver is going to cost you about $70. And that's the wrong item I have up there for you. Let me find the right one. Okay. So if you buy like a typical vacuum sealer, you're going to end up paying about two times as much for your bags as if you buy a chamber vac sealer. This particular one here by Vavor is one of the most affordable ones. Now, I bought one over $1,000. These are on sale right now for $336. I don't see how you don't get your money back out of these just in the quality of being able to do a better job saving your food. Because here's the other thing. I always hated Food Savers for this. Inevitably, one little drop of moisture goes up into where the seal is and you put the food in the freezer and you look in there a week later and the bag has failed and you got freezer burn on the food. So you didn't actually, you'd have been better off with a Ziploc bag than you know, vac sealing it. So, or it fails. So you stick it inside another bag and another bag, you know, with like three bags to do the job of one bag. These chamber vacs, as long as there's nothing sharp that pokes a hole in it, they're pretty foolproof because you can set how long you pull a vacuum, how long you cool, how long you seal. And so you can adjust to the thickness of the bags you buy. The bags cost about half as much. And it opens up so many more things because you can vacuum seal liquids. Now, if you vacuum seal a liquid, it needs to be cool. Like 100 degrees is not cool. Lukewarm is not cool. Liquid boils at much lower temperatures in a vacuum than in a non-vacuum. In fact, a lot of times, even with a cool liquid, you'll get a little bubbling in there, but nothing bad happens. When you put like 100 degree, you think it cooled off enough liquid into a vacuum seal bag and put a chamber vac, you get a mess. Ask me how I know. But if you follow those rules, you can vacuum seal, you know, stuff with 2 cups of moisture to liquid marinade in there with it. So what happens when you do a marinade with a chamber vac, because you are pulling all the air out and creating a vacuum, the meat itself pulls the marinade in much faster. And I would tell you, I think in many instances, a lot of marinades are more effective at 30 minutes to an hour in a chamber vac bag than they are overnight in a refrigerator without it. That's how good it is. And then the beauty is you can marinate meats with a chamber vac. You can label them. Yeah, throw them in the freezer. They're ready to go when you pull them out. Now you're doing your own freezer section. And it, unlike the garbage that's in the freezer section at the supermarket, you know exactly what's in it. You can pull that marinated piece of meat up. You can defrost it and cook it however you, you know, on a grill, open charcoal, flat top, pan, roast, whatever. Or you can throw it in a sous vide and sous vide it and then go ahead and sear it off. It's up to you. You have flexibility. These are a fantastic, fantastic tool. I used to say, you know, if you can't afford one, just get a food saver. And I still say that to a degree, but now that we're not talking $1,200, now you're talking $300. You see what I mean? And then the beauty of these is when you buy these bigger cuts and you're breaking them down yourself and all, you can store that food in your freezer in a way that you know it's going to be protected. And again, I'm back to, okay, if I buy the food saver for $75, I buy this for $330. If I'm paying twice as much for the bags, and you will, how long does it take before I've spent the same money, and now every single bag I buy for the food saver, when I get less performance, less flexibility, less capability, I'm in the hole. I don't think it makes sense anymore unless you just have no alternative. I would save up and use things like Ziploc bags and butcher's paper before I'd buy a food saver today if I were in the market for a new vacuum sealer. There's just like, I should do a show on all the things you can do with a chamber vac because it's pretty amazing. Next is you want a good meat thermometer. And you want that meat thermometer not for the main reason people think that you do, which is it's very dangerous to eat undercooked meat and you could die. That's probably not going to happen. Now, there are certain things that you really don't want to eat undercooked. Pork being chief among them because trichinosis is bad. However, the number that is given to you for trichinosis prevention by the government is ridiculous. I think they recently reduced pork to 145 is the temperature you can cook pork to, which is still a little over to me for a lot, not all, but a lot of cuts. The number that you need to reach and hold for about 5 minutes to make sure that's not a problem with pork is 137 degrees. So I'm back to, if you sous vide it, you can hold it there for 30 minutes and it's going to be fine. And then you can sear it off and not even come back to that temperature if you let it cool down before you sear it, and you can have really juicy, slightly rare pork and not worry about it. And it's very, very good that way. But you cook to any temperature you want, I guess. But the main thing that a good meat thermometer does is it prevents you from overcooking the meat. Because people, especially people that didn't learn to cook by somebody that knew what they were doing, tend to be paranoid about meat. You know, I mentioned my two grandmothers. I'll tell you another difference they had. When I'm talking a little kid here. Give me some grace. I'm talking like 11 years old, 12 years old. I said to my dad one time, why does Grandma Spirico make a beef roast and Grandma Moyer makes a roast beef? He said, they're the same thing. I'm like, no, they're not. See, my Grandma Spirico makes a beef roast. It tastes like jerky and not good. Like, you put gravy on it and it absorbs it. It's completely gray. It's cooked to death. And my Grandma Moyer makes this roast beef. And it's a little pink in the middle. It's all juicy. And he's like, you can never say that out loud to either of your grandmothers. You cannot say that. I'm like, okay, explain it to me. He said, your Grandma Spirico, that's his mom, is from the old country, Europe. When she came to this country, they didn't have refrigeration yet. When your granddad went to World War II, They had just gotten electricity. She's old school, and she's afraid to undercook meat. Your grandma Moyer doesn't have that problem. That's why you think they're different, but it's the same thing. I'm like, wow, that stuck with me, right? I'm still telling the story today, 46 years later, you know? But that's reality. Like, when you overcook meat, you ruin it. You cook meat a long time to make it tender, depending on how. Low and slow and moist, then you get tender. Hot and fast or roasting, you really don't want to – you want to cook meats that way that you do not want to overcook. So I really recommend that everybody have a good meat thermometer. The one I recommend is made by a company called Thermo Maven. This is my favorite meat thermometer. It's incredibly accurate. I own like three of them because I bought one for somebody who didn't need one because I'd already bought them one. And then Dorothy thought she gave it away when she didn't, so she ordered me another one. Didn't I have, so I have three of them. That's allowed me to put three of them in the same piece of meat side by side and read them all within 1 degree of each other. Excellent. The other thing, most of these instant read meat thermometers, they kind of open like a switchblade knife. They use some weird little effed up like hearing aid type battery, which is fine. I have them for like optics and things like that. They're all the same. I can't remember what they're called now, the number on them. But in these thermometers, it's like you need a degree in engineering to replace one. They just don't want to stay in there. Whatever. These use a freaking, it's either a AA or AAA. I don't remember which. But it's take one screw out, throw a battery in it, and you're done. And I love that about them. They're accurate. They have a bottle opener on them and a magnet so that you can keep one. Now that I have extras, I keep like one on the side of the refrigerator and I keep one out with the grill, just on the side of the stand for the grill because they're magnetic. The most valuable thing in the world, if you like meat, is being able to make sure you're not overcooking. So get a good meat thermometer and learn how to use it. Dry brining. Dry brining to me is superior to wet brining. I don't even consider wet brining brining. I know it's heresy. To me, it's more like a type of a marinade than it is a true brine. And what I mean by that is like you have to deal with all this liquid. And if you think about something like Thanksgiving is really a lot closer than it feels, guys. Dry brining a turkey is so much easier than wet brining a turkey. You have a 22-pound bird. You have like a small garbage pan to get it into the liquid brine fully. Or you have to part it out to do it. And then maybe you're in multiple containers, and it's at a time of year when your refrigerator space is at a premium and what have you. Dry brine is simple. You mix up your dry brine, and you cover it with it. And dry brine basically always includes salt and then what other flavors you want to work with. The brine helps tenderize the meat. It helps flavor the meat, and it helps dry the meat out. One of the things you'll learn as you cook, if you want beautiful Maillard reaction where you get the nice golden brown and delicious skin, surface, sear, whatever, you want dry and you want tacky. And you get that in spades with a good dry marinade. And I use dry marinades constantly dry brining constantly with like even steaks, because almost every piece of meat I make gets a coating of salt, maybe some other things, and goes in the refrigerator and gets turned a time or two on a cooling rack nested in a sheet pan. You get that tacky nature. Couple things happen. One, if you're searing, you get a much better sear. Two, if you are smoking, that tackiness, when that smoke is rolling over that piece of meat that you're smoking, more of the flavor components and characteristics of the smoke stick, almost like a sauce to the meat. Like if you talk to a real pitmaster barbecue guy in like South Texas and you say, what's your sauce? They'll say the smoke is the sauce. What do you flavor your meat with? They'll be like salt, pepper, garlic. That's it. A lot of them are just salt. They don't even use pepper. And they're like, you put whatever you want in it when you eat it. The smoke is the flavor. Without that tackiness, though, that doesn't happen. So when you do a brisket, a dry brine on a brisket is money. And again, flip it and get one of the little fans. I didn't have it in the show notes. Maybe I'll add it. Little fans I've been marketing, little $14 rechargeable fans. Set that in your refrigerator when you're dry brining. That'll help keep that surface moisture off, because what usually happens, like a steak or something, you flip it over and the bottom's wet. And so then the top gets nice and tacky and the bottom's wet again. because it's still drawing moisture out of that meat, right? Now, it's not going to make it dry unless you leave it there for like a week or some shit, right? Where you have a super thin cut of meat where you're basically making salted meat. Don't do that. Thick piece of meat, good dry brine. And then this is a little chemistry, a little osmotic chemistry, right? If you put some seasonings, like let's say some thyme, garlic, ground up fennel, and you do this with a thick cut pork chop, what happens is that salt starts to pull water out of the meat, and then some surface water forms, and then eventually you have an osmotic reaction where everything seeks equilibrium. And so when some of the moisture goes back into the meat, it takes the flavorings and the herbs and the essential oils in them with it into the meat, and you get a deeper penetration. So you get all that tackiness, that pellico on the outside of the meat, but you also get more flavor deep into the meat, and you get a really great crust with that flavor as well. Then resting meat. Resting your meat is important. Don't make jokes. Don't go, rest your meat, right? Don't do that, right? All I mean is that when that meat is done being cooked and you pull it out of the oven, out of the pan, off the grill, whatever, put it on something like a cutting board and leave it alone. Leave it alone. Usually around, depending on how thick it is, how much it's going to cool down, around 10 minutes. Especially anything with some thickness to it. Anything you're going to go into and slice. Like if you're talking about like a super thin cut, like charred, like Korean barbecue or something, you don't really have to worry about it very much. But anything that would be like a steak, a chop, something like that, a roast, let it rest. Now, if you watch TV cooking shows, they will say the most moronic, stupid, retarded reason for this. So the juices can go down back inside. If the juices could go back down inside, this would not be that important. The juices never go back inside. When it comes out, it's done. What happens is all your fats, all your oils, and your limited amount of water that's in that meat is now under heat and pressure. And the fats in particular have more viscosity, right? They're thinner. So if you think about it as an extreme example, if you have a jar of olive oil sitting on your countertop and you have a jar of olive oil in the refrigerator for a few hours, the stuff in the refrigerator will literally look like a paste. You won't be able to pour it, and the stuff on the counter will pour pretty easily. If you put the jar that was on the counter in the microwave for 30 seconds, it'll pour almost like water. It'll get very, very thin. So when you cut into that hot meat, the pressure and the heat and the high viscosity of that oil flows and all your juices come out. So it's not that the juices go back down inside, which is again is a something that whoever started that should be found and beaten with like a large frozen fish, something in the salmon family, for the misery they've caused to people and the misinformation that they've caused to people. It is nonsense. It is absolute bullshit. However, what you're waiting for is so that when you cut into the meat, not everything runs out. The other thing is when you cook, especially like your red meats, like your beefs and all, to a very rare temperature, when you cut it like that, it looks like blood pours out of it. Now, it's actually called myoglobin. It's not blood. It's the meat's been bled out. And the technical name for complaining about myoglobin on your plate is you're being a little bitch, but it doesn't look good. And if you serve it like something like mashed potatoes, it really, when it bleeds into the mashed potatoes, it doesn't look good at all, right? You got this red goo in your mouth. Okay. When you let the damn thing rest, that doesn't happen. So now you can have that nice medium to medium rare or even rare piece of meat, and you don't have a bloody plate, which turns a lot of people off, all right? Learn to rest your meat. And here's the thing, the reality of living in 2026, especially for young people today, if you want to eat well and succeed economically at the same time, you need to learn this stuff. You know, we have had about a 30-year period where there's a lot of people that cook almost no food at home. And that means that we have a lot of 30-year-old people, you know, there was a 30-year span of that. They were 10 when they started paying attention. They've gone 20 years and that's been their lives and they've never learned to cook. This shit has to end. This shit has to end. Why do you think people are spending almost as much for a taxi ride for their food as they are for their food and overpaying for the food to boot? They don't know how to cook. And if they do know how to cook, what they mean by that is they know how to microwave something or take something with a Ore-Ida on it and open a bag and put it on a pan and stick it in the oven at 350 for 25 minutes. This is not cooking. This is reheating. If you want to eat really, really, really well, right, today, then you need to learn how to do this stuff. And the younger you are, probably the more true that becomes, because generally speaking, people who have been around a little less time make a little less money. Like, I mean, I had somebody tell me recently, like, you know, you think you're all that with your podcast and all, but most of your audience is old. And by old, they mean like 40, right? Like, I'm in my 50s. I'm like, that's good. And they're like, why? I'm like, because old people have money, right? I want people in my audience that can buy shit. I want to be able to sell them something. You know, I don't want a bunch of people, like, they have a million followers and they're all broke. You can't make a buck. But that aside, like, we do need to learn how to put money back in our pocket by not spending it in the first place. And that doesn't mean eating garbage. That doesn't mean eating junk food. That doesn't help us. And again, if you think that good food's expensive, where do you see how much, you know, medication costs? Where do you see how much dialysis costs? Go look at the five biggest lifestyle illnesses in the United States. Chief among them will be type 2 diabetes. Look at the cost of maintenance medication for those. And real quick, you realize that food's not expensive at all. It's just about where your money gets spent. And that is why our poor are fat in America. Have you ever thought about the fact that, like, the most obese population in America are people on food stamps? You know what they're also on? Medicaid. They're on Medicaid. They have free health care. They don't pay for all that shit. We do. So they buy their fudge rounds in the, you know, in the words of the song and what have you, and they get incredibly morbidly obese eating, and they say, oh, I don't eat that much. They're starving while they're obese. There's no nutrient density. The way we talked about cooking today, extremely nutrient dense, delicious food. All right. So anyway, let's go ahead and wrap things up. I do have a couple, like, question comments, just two. If you have one and you are not Carl Hall or No Censorship 2002, go ahead and ask it now. Last call for questions or comments. Carl says, please show Ion Herb Gardening. Okay, I think what he wants is a show on herb gardening, and we'll do that again soon. I haven't done that for a long time. Maybe we'll do that next Tuesday. It's a real easy show to put together, and there's like about 12 herbs that if you just container garden those or plant them in your, you know, like if you have a suburban home, you could do a lot of herb gardening in your front yard, right with your ornamentals. You know, mints, chives are a great ground cover, super easy, super hardy. Onion chives, I'm not a huge fan of them. I'm just ripping them out and I can't get rid of them. I like the onion chives better than the garlic chives, but those are a freaking weed. I've pulled some out, threw them on the ground, and came back and they rooted and started growing again. There's a lot we can do with that, so I will make that happen for you, Carl. And then No Censorship says, why do people worry about trichinosis with confinement-raised commercial pork? They're not rooting or eating other contaminated animals, wild ones and bears. Yes, you would think that. The United States commercial pork supply has the highest trichinosis percentage when tested in the world. Now, it's about 2%, but it is definitely a thing because you don't know what they're feeding them. And a pig will eat anything. Including, you know, confinement. Yeah. You don't think there's any rats, right? Or any garbage that gets drug in there or whatever. So it does happen. I will tell you that trichinosis can also be killed with freezing. I believe the number is something like -5 for at least 30 days. So when I've done like cured meats like capricolas and stuff out of pork, that's what I'll do. I'll put it in my deep chest freezer. I'll set a thing on the calendar, leave it in the bottom where the coldest area is for 30 days as kind of a stopgap measure. It is a low risk with confinement pork. It is not a no risk, just so that you do know that. When I started getting into curing meats, I checked into that because I thought it was important. I don't see any more questions, so I'm going to wrap up. Again, I want to remind you guys, the fall workshop on the 19th, goes on sale at 9 a.m. If I said 9:30 earlier, it was a mistake. It's been 9:30 in the past. 9 a.m., the 19th, Saturday morning, Central Standard Time. If you are on the Telegram group or channel, I'm going to drop that link there exactly at 9 a.m. That's the best way to make sure that you can sign up. But it will also be posted to the blog. So you can just check the blog at 9 a.m. and you'll be able to sign up for it. I think this year is going to sell out really fast. Just based on chatter and feedback and people asking me about things and what have you. And again, I'm going to tell you that if you've never been to one of our workshops and you've always been like, one day I'm going to do it. Remember, we don't get to choose how many days we have in life, and we don't get to choose our future. We get to choose our present, and we get to target our future. So hopefully everybody will be around for a long time, and hopefully everybody will be able to do things like this for a long time. But if you can make it happen this year, please consider coming. I am telling you, this event will change your life. And I know that's a big claim to make. And when I started doing them, I would have never made that claim, nor would I have ever said that's what they're going to become. You'll come here and learn some stuff about permaculture. You come here and you'll learn some stuff about aquaponics or hydroponics or whatever, or, you know, making IMOs or whatever, doing homesteading stuff and making, we've done herbal medicine classes, all kinds of stuff. You'll learn stuff. That's the same as every other event you ever go to like this. This is different. The people here are your people. This is your tribe. If you have never been, you haven't met them yet. I'm going to tell you what happens on Wednesday with the people that have been here before. And I want you to understand that even though what I'm about to say is true, you will be welcome. You will not feel like an outsider at all. We go out of our way to make sure that doesn't happen for people. But you will watch people start showing up about 1:30, even though they're not supposed to show up to 2. You know, about 1:30, they'll start trickling in. They start coming in. My parking Nazis are doing their job, getting everybody parked. You start seeing people come in. They start matriculating over to the porch and setting up their tents and everything like that. And the number one thing you see people doing each other is hugging each other. And if you're not a hugger, that's okay. You don't have to. I'm just saying, these are people that have been coming here, some of them since 2013. And the way I've heard it put, and this is one of the biggest compliments I've ever had, this is where I go to see my friends once a year. There are people, they take some of their vacation time every year to come here. What we do here is different than anything else you've experienced at any other type of event like this. By keeping the headcount to 50, we keep it small. If you don't get to talk to me during this event, it's because I didn't know that you were hiding from me. I make myself available. I'm usually up. Like the first night, I've started to go to bed a bit earlier. But, you know, like Friday and Saturday, I'm up till like 2 o'clock in the morning. And then I'm up first thing in the morning getting everything ready for you guys again. I don't run in the house. I don't hide. I don't have, you know, people walking around keeping you away from me. I am right in it with you. I cook for you. Let me tell you one of the reasons, like I like doing shows about cooking, but why I like cooking for you? You guys have done so effing much for me in my life. And I think when you cook for people, you serve them. And like we say that you like being a server at a restaurant, but I think when you actually cook for people, you're serving them at a high level. And I want to do that for you guys. And I want you to come experience it. I want you to experience Chef Ken doing that for you. The thing we're going to come up with. So Nicole Sauce is probably going to bring down her Cajachina, which is the China box for roasting like whole pigs and shit. We're going to roast like a whole lamb. Maybe we're going to do like a lamb goat mix thing. Like we haven't figured it out yet. That's going to be just a Saturday night meal. One of the things on the menu, Jamaican jerk chicken sauce, the Jamaican pork sausage that I'm making right now. That will be on the Saturday night menu. We have smoked pork shoulder opening up on 9-1, a burger bar. We have sandwiches. Chef Ken is going to come in. I've been growing a bunch of golden mushrooms, golden oysters. Chef Ken's going to do a mushroom soup to go with. So we're going to have soup and sandwiches on Friday. Friday night, we're doing fajitas cooked on site, catered by a place called Lupe Tortilla. They're amazing. This is not your typical thing that you go to like a permaculture thing and they charge you $800 and then you eat broccoli and freaking tofu or some crap like that. We have tastings usually. We do like either a rum or a whiskey tasting. Sometimes we do multiples of those. Bar or blanket. Guys, if you've never been, come experience something totally different. And I'm going to make you a promise. If you bring the right attitude, like you're actually here to listen, to learn, to meet people, to become part of a bigger group, you won't want to leave when it's time to leave. That's the biggest compliment I've had is the small group of people still hanging out at the gate. It's 5 minutes till off the property time, and I have to send somebody to push them off, and they go down to a donut place or something and have breakfast before everybody drives home. They don't want it to go away. Please consider coming. Another announcement as I ride off today. We are launching the How to Find a Business That Matches You course. There's an article that will come out about it today. That is going to be 9 a.m. Monday next week. So that's the 14th, I think. We're launching that. That will not sell out because it can't. As many people as want to buy it can, but we are doing the first 100 get it for $69, the second 100 get it for $79, and then it goes to $99. It's going to be a really great course. I'll have more information for you on it tomorrow. Take care. I see no more questions. Again, please consider coming to TSP Fall 26. It's going to be one of the best workshops ever.
Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you'll